Accession number 9424, Reel 11.
Mr. Cooper, Reel 11. Were there any other obstacles that you had to face walking through this area at night, like shell holes, for example?
No, there weren't any shell holes on this, because they started using the instantaneous fuse shells, so that meant the shell directly touched, they had a projecting little point, directly touched the ground, it exploded, you see, whereas in the past all the shells had buried themselves in the ground and then exploded. The reason being, of course, in trench warfare, that's what they wanted. They wanted them to blow the trench up. But with this more or less open warfare, they just wanted the shell to explode. Another thing, another new type of shell they had with not so much the heavy guns, but with the field guns, they had a shell that the trajectory was very shallow, so that they hit the ground almost level with the ground. And then these were shrapnel shells, and then they exploded, and all the shrapnel just spread out in front of the shell at ground level.
Did you know they were using these shells at the time?
I didn't know at the time, no. Yeah. Well, I knew, yes, the instantaneous fuse for the big shell, I knew that, but I didn't know about the shrapnel shells that skidded along the ground and exploded, more like firing a gun on the ground. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you have so? The ground itself was unmarked, really, by shell fire.
Yes. Well, it's hard, practically unmarked. There were no shell holes, anyway.
And you were delivering your officers to the front line.
Yes.
You could take up the story from there.
Yes. And then, when we delivered, I was on my own then with them, yes. Just made my way back, no shell fire. Went down one of the dugouts and pretty full up, I went to sleep on the steps.
You mentioned the use of new types of weapons. Earlier on you talked about the British tanks. Was that the first time you'd seen
British
tanks?
The first time I'd seen them in action. When we were soon after we landed and were up to the front by train, I saw one or two going along the road, and that was quite exciting to see them, but I hadn't seen them in action. They couldn't use tanks on the Labassé front, I suppose, because of the terrain. But oh yes, there were five or six. I mean, of course, they had really done their work a bit earlier during the actual advance, which I didn't. As I told you, we soon saw about 200 prisoners coming in. So the tanks we saw weren't actually firing their guns. Really. They were just all over you might call it a plain. And the German guns were firing, and so we kept, when we were on our messages, we kept well away from them, because the Germans were trying to give them direct hits with their shells. Didn't see them hit any, but they were, because the tanks were zigzagging and moving around. But
would you say they were fairly effective in what they were trying to do?
I should think they were in the main advance, yes, because I think the Germans were terrified of the tanks, as we would be too. See these great monsters with firing their machine guns and small caliber guns from the side.
What was your first impression when you saw them? Had you heard of them before?
Oh, yes, I'd heard of them, yes, I'd heard of tanks. Yeah. Just rather excitement to actually see them, yes.
Did you actually, were you ever able to talk to anyone who...
Never able, no. And of course, one thing I forgot to tell you, that when we got to the German trench, we found an anti-tank rifle, which they had. And the bullets from an anti-tank rifle could pierce the tank armour. And so our battalion took this anti-tank gun, and I took one or two of the expended shells from it.
And what, you returned that to BHQ, did you?
No, it's in my drawer upstairs.
Were you in the Arras front line for very long?
No, as soon as very soon after this attack had taken place, we were relieved by another, not by, I don't think it was our division, we were relieved anyway. And I remember the next morning, some of the Canadians came over, and they appreciated the King's, because we were the only battalion with them, you see, we were on their left. And they brought great tins of fancy biscuits, and we all held out our steel hats, and they filled everyone's steel, not everybody, but all the group, with these lovely fancy biscuits, which of course terrific for us, and as a thank you for the support we'd given them. Because the attack on the Drocourt Queant Line was a Canadian affair, and the King's Own were just had the couple of companies on their left. And they experienced a lot of casualties, especially on the right. They were held up by machine guns, and there's a cemetery near Drury now, which all the headstones are an inch apart.
And they're presumably all Canadian dead, aren't they?
All Canadian dead.
Were you aware of that at the time, that the Canadians had taken the brunt of that action?
Oh yes, we knew it was a Canadian action, really, and we were just, I don't know who was on their right or further to the left, because it was a fairly long front, but I know we were just the King's Own battalion on there, not the whole battalion at once, I think it was two companies on the, or three companies, on the left of the Canadians.
Is this the first time you've come across troops from
it was,
elsewhere yes. in the Commonwealth?
Yes, excepting on the, when we were on La Basse, we had an American doctor.
What was the British troops' reaction to the Canadians?
Oh, they just took them for granted. There didn't seem to be any action. But this American doctor was the only American I saw while I was in France. Of course, they were well below south, you see, the American troops.
Something you said about the biscuits makes me want to know if the Canadians actually had different rations to the British.
I think much better, because I remember it was when we were on the way to Arras marching, we stopped near a Canadian canteen, and we got tinned fruit and goodness knows what from there. Oh yes, very much more so. And I expect the Americans were too. Mm. Yes.
Right, if we could return to, you were describing leaving the Arras front line, going off for the rest of the company rest period.
That's when I spoke about the train and being shelled, wasn't it?
Well, you haven't described it yet, I think.
So I just talked to you about it. Oh, I thought I'd describe
no.
it.
No. So could you describe what happened to you?
Yes. Are we still
yes, yes.
Yes, well, when we marched away from there, well, probably a couple of miles back, and then there was we knew we were going back on rest, and there was a long train of cattle trucks or horse vans, and we were waiting for that, and it arrived, and nothing then seemed to happen. There were several hundred troops all sitting around there on the grass, and while we were there, we saw, I think, one or two German planes very high up in the sky circling around, and we all thought, hello, they'll have spotted us and probably advised their artillery well back, and it wasn't in 5 minutes we heard the roar of shells coming and exploding round the railway tracks, and of course all the chaps were moving and telling everyone to get a move on and get in. So we all got into the train waiting for it, and it still didn't move for some time. These shells were coming, and suddenly there was a jangling of the couplings, etc., and the puff of the engine, and off we went. As far as I know, nobody was killed. I don't know, but we didn't see anybody killed.
Was there any move when the spotter planes were sighted to sort of move the troops? Or?
No, neither. Well, there was really nowhere to move them to, I suppose. But they soon got their message back to their artillery, just the same as we would have done if it had been the case with us.
Where did the train take you?
Took us to La Thaloy, a little village, probably, I don't know, perhaps 10, 12 miles behind the line, no sign of war, no, couldn't hear guns or machine guns or anything else, complete rest. And as the same on previous rest, we hadn't to do anything. We didn't stay there very long. I think it was about after a week we were all on the move again, marching towards Cambrai. And we did several marches every day. And
what were the conditions like on these marches? Was it still a very hot summer?
It was hot summer, but we marched mainly in... We did march in the afternoon, but we did quite a lot of marching at night. And going through these... And there was always someone had gone ahead to provide a billet in an empty house or... No, we didn't... It was all in old empty houses and places, so we'd just stay the night.
Were there any problems of supplying you with rations whilst you were moving?
Well, I wasn't aware of any. We still got them. You see, there was always battalion transport moving up with us when we were moving, so they would bring the rations. Yes, we still had the rations, about the same. And when we got to... when we got to Cambrai, of course, that had been overrun and taken, well, some days before at least. Very little, there were houses wrecked, but it was still quite a big town, and you didn't notice much wreckage. And we got a billet in an old house on the top floor, which was, except for having no windows, it was undamaged. And we really set ourselves up beautifully there. We went crouching around, and we found a table, and we found some chairs. And we put, in one corner, we put blankets on the floor with straw underneath to sleep on. And I think we found some rabbits. And we had a marvellous dinner. We got some potatoes from somewhere, cooked them. And when we were settled down eating lunch, a sergeant came in and looked at us. He said, God's truth, I thought I'd come to the officer's mess.
How many were there in that billet with you?
There were just the HQ observers, that was about it, and I think two or three of the pioneers.
What did the pioneers do?
Well, they did all trench construction and that, so we never saw them at work, but that's the general duties they did.
What was the name of the town that you were in there?
This was outside Cambrai, on the outskirts of Cambrai.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, we could still we could still hear machine guns in the distance, and some shelling. And during the day, we just went to the Cambrai Canal, and we found a lot of German hand grenades, Mills bombs, and that. And we went to the canal, throwing them into. Because we heard that some of the chaps had been thrown in and it had stunned, they'd been catching fish because it had stunned them. But we didn't get any fish, but it was good fun. And then they had these little, egg bombs, the Germans had a little egg bomb about 2 inches long of cast iron. And those had a little cord on you, just pulled and it set the fuse going. Very explosive. And then they had we found quite a lot of German potato masher bombs, because they look like a potato masher with a tin on the end and a long stick. We used quite a lot of those too. And we also found a lot of German cartridges, and we noticed on the base of the cartridge some were a little green circle and some were red and some were black. So we found some German rifles and started using these, and we'd often heard about the Germans using explosive bullets. And we found the red ones were explosive bullets, because we got a German aluminium hot water bottle as a target and fired at it. And where the bullet went in was just a round hole, but the other side was a mass of holes where it had exploded inside.
Can you remember what the other two bullets were, the green one and the black one?
No, I think, yes. One of them was tracer bullet. That is, you shoot them and they leave a trail. Used was mainly at planes, or to find your target by seeing the trajectory was coloured, and the others were just ordinary ones.
Where did you find all this equipment? Was this just strewn
along in the abandoned trenches outside Cambrai? See, the troops had gone through about a week before, and there were still some bodies lying around, and then we didn't stay there long. Then we moved on. The troops were advancing all the time now to different not only our different divisions and so on, so it was just I don't think there was hardly a pause of more than a day or two going forward, and then we got to a place. So let's see, Salzwar, we stepped in. That was being shelled by high velocity guns every so often for the Germans, and then we got to a little town called Verschein, or as the Germans call it, Verschein, and we were billeted then in a cellar. That's where the observers selected.
Whilst you were in this advance forward, did you have any specific duties? Were you still a runner rather than an observer?
It wasn't really anything then. There certainly wasn't an observer. I think they'd more or less forgotten about us by then, and we hoped they would lose us.
Were any of the King's Own actually involved in fighting at this point, or were you just...
Oh, the King's Own were, yes. Yes, I remember outside Verschein, the King's Own were going to advance the next morning, and there was a barrage at midnight. And instead of fighting anything, I was lying asleep in the cellar and listening to all the thunder of the guns going. And then we went forward, and then it was getting on towards end of... Well, when the end of October by now, and the next, and as it turned out, the final attack by the King's Own was against a place called Kerenang, Q-U-E-R-E-N-A-I-N-G, on a slope, and there was another barrage, and we found lots of German dead and British dead, and then we got to Kerenang, and the civilians started coming back. The Germans had driven out, and we were in cellars, and then civilians came in, and we were in the same cellar as civilians. There were a few beds there and mattresses, etc., but actually Kerenang was still, after we'd taken it, was still being shelled. And I remember one condition on the road, there were some very heavy shells coming all like express trains and thundering behind us. Anyway, then they increased the range. And
how often were you moving forward in this march? Was it every day that you'd move forward?
Every day or so, yes.
And how far did you move forward?
We moved forward to Kerenang.
Well, I mean, in terms of distance,
mile or two, I suppose.
Was there much
hard to remember?
Yes. Is there much evidence of war? I mean, you mentioned the dead.
No, just a few wrecked houses and roofs off, and bodies lying around. Mm-hmm. German bodies. Mainly.
Yes. What was the terrain like at Canberra?
Fairly flat outside, more like Alice outside Canberra. But as we got towards Verschein, Salzwar and Kerenang, it was undulating country. Mm-hmm. And when we'd been in Kerenang some time, they had a big divisional parade. The troops ahead already had captured Valenciennes, which was ahead of a really big city. And it was about the 8th of November. And we had this big divisional parade and the general inspecting it, etc. And we heard there was going to be an armistice. Well, to us, an armistice was just going to be a few weeks' cessation of the fighting. And we heard that the plenipotentiaries were being met, etc. But we didn't believe it was anywhere near the end of the war. And then when we came back from this divisional inspection outside our billets, well, the officer just said an armistice has been signed with the Germans at 11 o'clock this morning. And we just... So he said, so we hope the war is over. And we just sort of gave a slight cheer, but we didn't believe it. We thought that it would all start again in another week. But of course it never did, and that was the end of the war.
Yes. Well, how long did it take you to realise that the armistice was
a... A few days, when in outside battalion headquarters they had the terms of the armistice. The German fleet to go to Scapa Flow, all machine guns, so many thousand machine guns and artillery to be handed over, and that the German troops should go back so many miles, etc. And then that really convinced us that it was over. But then I used to dream that it had started again. I think it was quite a few weeks before I really got down to the fact that there was going to be no more war, and that we were not going into the trenches again.
Mm. Were there any particular celebrations?
None at all.
What about the civilian population?
Well, they were starting coming back then to Quirinay, and they had been taken away during our advance, and the King's Own set up soup kitchens at the end of the village to welcome all the people back to their billets. And the mayor of the town, we were in Quirinay about 2 weeks there, well, after the war, and they named various streets after, they named one Rue La King's Own, Rue Bazanke, that was one of the captains of the company, and after a few officers in the company, they named the streets after them.
Was that a permanent arrangement, the renaming?
Oh, I don't think so. I expect after a few months or weeks, they went back to their old names.
What was the relationship and the atmosphere like between the British troops and
the very civilians? Good, because we did meet quite a few of them, and they were very grateful to the company, to the battalion, for receiving and providing them with food as they came back.
And what was your own situation? How long did you stay in Quirinay?
We stayed there, about, I suppose, a week, and then the King's Own was still advancing beyond that towards Valenciennes. And the Germans were still putting out quite a bit of resistance. And I remember my my friend Burbage, who had been with the observers and was sent back to his company some time before, said he had a terrible time. They were on a railway cutting. He said they were shelled constantly for hours.
And this is all after the armistice?
No, sorry, this was after we had taken Quirinay.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes, that was,
yes.
I see.
And he just said what a terrible time they'd had, but that was the only time I never saw him again.
Why was that?
That's why we just didn't connect up.
I see. Did you yourself go up to Valenciennes?
Oh, yes, and we were billeted in an empty house, a new empty house too. And we got on quite well. There were some civilians down below, and they used to ask us down for soup, etc. Oh yes, quite a nice relationship there. And we were only about a quarter of an hour away from the town or the city. And then, of course, the time came after that we went through into Belgium. Into near Mons, and the battalion were billeted in a little nice little town called Morlanway. Had never been. I think in 1914 the German troops went through and there was a bit of a battle, but otherwise it was perfectly normal. And
how did you get to Morlanway?
Went by lorries, coaches, until we got outside the town. And to make an impression, we all unloaded there, and the battalion brass band, and the whole battalion marched into Waterloo, into Morlanway, behind the banner. All of the civilians were out waving and cheering, and all the kids rushing up and saying, "Souvenir, souvenir." Well, it got a terrific welcome then, because they had never seen the troops. They knew that the Germans had been forced right back then, because it was probably a week or two after they had resumed normal life, but they hadn't seen any troops. And of course, the brass band coming in, etc., and all the English troops, they got a terrific welcome. And all civilians were so good too. I was billeted in the house with another chap, and the Monsieur and Madame Renoir gave up their best bedroom for us to sleep there. Lace embroidered sheets, and she, although we had our meals at the battalion mess, when we were going out on sentry duty or on duty at all, she always used to prepare soup soup for us and some tartine, etc. I kept up with them for years.
How did your duties change now that the war had ended in terms of the fighting that the King's Own had to do? What did you do now?
Just parades and marches and things really to fill in the time. But I wasn't very long in Morlan Way, perhaps 3 weeks, and then I got this job on the trains.
I see.
Well, I don't think you want to hear that, really.
Oh, well, I'd be most interested, actually, if you could.
Well, I can tell you, as a, yes. Well, when I'd be a, there was a, oh, we always had parades every year, and after a parade, one morning in the street outside the place where we were billeted, the sergeant major was saying, "Anybody here want a good job?" And he went up to him and he said, "What about you, so-and-so?" And this chap demurred, and now he was said. And he said, "Well, does anybody want a good job?" And I went, "I'd like a good job, sir." He said, "Oh." He said, have you ever been a waiter?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "Well," he said, they want four from each company about to go down to Boulogne to to man the officer's leave train from Boulogne to Cologne." I said, "Oh, I'd like that." He said, "All right." He said, "Sunday night, be ready at 11 o'clock and you'll be called and you'll go to the train to go down to Boulogne." This was January. So I must have been there longer than they, as I'd probably there perhaps there in a month. So went to the railway siding, darn cold. And in the end, a cattle truck train came, troops were going down, some were going on leave and so on. And it didn't start for an hour. It took us 4 days to get to Boulogne in January. No heat, of course, just because we were used to that. And we stopped at certain places on the line where there was a EFC canteen to get our meals. And when we arrived at Boulogne, we were billeted in the officers' leave club in Boulogne, and we went to where the officers had slept. We went to dormitory, each bed curtained off and a lock of something like a hospital ward. And when we had our meals, we were served by orderlies, tomatoes and bacon for breakfast and everything. And then the call came, then we got moved from there after a few days up to St. Martin's camp outside Boulogne on the hillside. And then we were given jobs, mm-hmm. because they weren't ready for us on the trains, apparently.
What sort of jobs did they give you?
Well, the first job I had, I said, "Well, I don't want to be a waiter." And he said, "Oh, well, fine." So I was a handyman in the pantry.
What did that consist of?
Or helping with the washing up and cleaning, etc. And then after that I got a night watchman. And the chaps that were on the show, there was a marquee outside the mess and just mattresses on the floor and dirty blankets. And then as night watchman, I came on duty at 5 at night, or 6 perhaps later. Then I had to clean the mess room, light, set the fire for the next morning, and then be there all night. And the chef in the kitchen there, he'd say, "Well, now have a good meal." He said, "Here's the key to the pantry. There are plenty of eggs and milk and bacon. Help yourself." And there's a big porringer on the stove, so about 1 o'clock in the morning I used to sit down, have a big plate of porridge, and I'd open a tin of carnation.